Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Charles Solomon, critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, Wade Major of Cinegods.com, and Leah Lowenstein with us. Our Film Week critics are going to take us through a big week at the movies, and no surprise, what our first film is, Star Wars The Last Jedi, starring Daisy Ridley, John Boyega, Adam Driver, Oscar Isaac, Carrie Fisher is in the film, Mark Hamill. It's written and directed by Rian Johnson. Lael, you want to start us on the new Star Wars?
Yes, I was so thrilled, Larry, that this is everything I wanted it to be. It was an outstanding trip back to the saga, and it wasn't slavishly devoted in the way that Force Awakens was a few years ago, where although I was relieved that it wasn't as awful as the first three of the prequels, I felt in retrospect that Force Awakens didn't add too much new. It was sort of a rehash of A New Hope, which I guess it had to be to restore our faith in it. This, I think, moves the saga to new places. It does bring back familiar characters, Luke, Leia, the characters we met, the trio that we met in the last film, and some new characters. There's interesting representation of diversity. You see people of color represented. There's exciting battles. There's some moments that actually kind of reach down and grab you and just choke you up a little bit. And there's some beautiful imagery that fans of the original series will love and
so this one
appreciate.
Is your favorites of the series, it
I
sounds
think
like.
So. I think, and of course, the challenge with the middle episode of a trilogy, which this is how to move it along, but realize that you're not giving resolution to fans or to characters because it's the middle piece. Empire Strikes Back did that so very well and is widely considered to be pretty much the best of that original trilogy. I think this does an excellent job pushing it forward, adding a few new enhancements that expand on our definition or understanding of what the Force is. A couple of them, frankly, very relevant and contemporary, a deeper understanding of nature, the way nature connects us all. And so it's got sort of a little political message and some very wonderful meta kind of ruminations on what is a legend and what, you know, what fan love is and movie love. And so to me, it really, yes, it absolutely delivered. And I saw it with my 11-year-old son who was just in heaven. It was terrific.
I wish we were video streaming, because I love your expression. I can see your love for the film. And it's really cool to see. I wish our listeners could see it.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think it's shared by my colleague, Wade.
Well, let him. But first, Charles. Okay. Then I'm holding Wade the last on this.
I like the film, not quite as enthusiastically as Lael did. I think it is a little longer than it needs to be.
True.
I think it has more endings than it needs.
True.
I think that Daisy Ridley and John Boyega do a great job holding the franchise together. There are some spectacular effects. There are some very well choreographed fights, one of which is completely unnecessary, but it's really cool. It's also a lovely farewell piece for Carrie Fisher. You know, it's really sad when a performer you love and respect ends up like Orson Welles, where his last role was a voice in the GoBots movie. You know, this is much closer to, say, Vincent Price and Edward Scissorhands, where this is a very affectionate finale for her, where she plays, you know, great dignity and wisdom and strength, and you sort of already, you know, you see her ushered out, and that feels as just fitting. The another qualm that I have, though, is that in the first trilogy, the roots of the mastery of the Force and the whole Jedi philosophy are very much rooted in Japanese martial arts, and you have to train and study and apply yourself and discipline. And in the more recent films, it sort of becomes something hereditary, that you're just born with this natural connection to it. And I don't think that's nearly as interesting.
I think that's a question that is raised and not answered, frankly.
Yeah, but
is it hereditary or is it something else?
The other thing that I sort of had a qualm about is I think Adam Driver as Kylo Ren, the former son of Han and Leia, looks too much like a young Severus Snape. And I kept thinking of that whenever he was on camera, but that just may be my quirk. But the movie is a lot of fun, and I think it gives fans what they want.
It's also funny. There's some good laughs in there that are really nice. It brings a lightness
so
to
now
it.
For something completely different.
Here we go.
Here comes
Wade.
Major.
Wade, let's hear it.
I'm not the Grinch for a change.
Yeah, let's right? Welcome to the dark side. Okay.
So I readily admit fans are going to love this movie. And I think, and this is going to sound weird, but I think that's part of the problem. This is designed, as was The Force Awakens, to be fan service. And I don't think you can be fan service and be a good movie. I think you have to choose one of the two. We were talking about this earlier, and I'm going to bring the subject up because I know Alayla wants to talk about this too, which is the subject of nostalgia. When people saw Star Wars in 1977, as I did, last film I saw with my father before he passed, the same year, it was new, it was fresh, it was exhilarating, there was a sense of discovery and wonder. People don't want discovery and wonder from their Star Wars movies anymore. They want fan service. They want nostalgia. It's like Frank Sinatra at 75 singing songs you've heard for 50 years. No one wanted him to sing. I disagree.
Too. Yeah, I think that what people want is the comfort of the familiar with some plausible enhancements. And that's what you get here. You get some things that expand our understanding of the Force and what it's capable of. There's a whole
there's
sort of mind bridge thing.
Without giving anything away, there is so much that is shoehorned into this because fans want it to be.
But wait, I don't think, to jump in rudely for a moment, the original Star Wars wasn't that new. It was The Hidden Fortress. It was old serials. It was Flash Gordon,
But for a 12 or a 13-year-old kid, which I was, and which all those original Star Wars fans were, it was new. It was your entree to discovering those things. I found The Hidden Fortress after I saw Star Wars.
Okay.
So
Star Wars made use of the Western and of certain tropes that we didn't know at the time were what it was doing, but in fact that is what it was doing. And those things are so deeply embedded in our culture that they worked. And that's why that's why you can't take the discussion of Star Wars out of the question of nostalgia. And that's the case with any sequel or anything. And in fact, they're part and parcel of the same thing.
And I agree, but I don't think that necessarily makes this a good movie. I think it makes it a fan movie. And those are two different things.
Let him finish his thought on that because we got to move along to some other films.
I mean, other things that they're problematic here. I would have had fewer problems had someone taken a second pass, if they'd given, say, Lawrence Kasdan a pass on Rian Johnson's script. Rian Johnson wrote and directed this. He's a great director.
He did Looper.
In terms of the script, there are all kinds of sort of anachronistic things that don't feel long ago and far away in another galaxy. They feel like your Uncle Joe, the accountant in Glendale, could have said it yesterday.
Oh yeah.
And I can't give it away. I mean, we'll talk during the break on it. But they're just it'll be a phrase, and you just think, really? They really like a page turner. That's one that shows up. Page Turner. They don't say Page Turner a long time ago in a galaxy far away. The guy, my Uncle Joe, the accountant in Glendale, says it's a Page Turner. That's not dialogue that belongs in a Star Wars movie. So that took me out of it. And then, there's the whole thing that and Adam Driver is great. Don't get me wrong. Adam Driver is tremendous. And there are two scenes in this that I think are some of the best scenes in any Star Wars film. I'll be fair. There are two scenes. But two scenes in 2 hours and 20 minutes is not enough for me. And it just feels as though it keeps doing certain things, not because the story needs them, but because fans demand it.
Star Wars The Last Jedi, rated PG-13 in wide release. Ferdinand, animated comedy directed by Carlos Saldana. It is based on a children's book, Ferdinand the Bull. This also comes from 20th Century Fox Animation. Later this hour, we'll talk about what the future of that animation unit might be with Disney's pending acquisition of most of the assets of 20th Century Fox. Charles, what'd you think of Ferdinand?
Well, now I take the black mask of the Sith from Wade. This Ferdinand began as a very charming children's book in 1936. It's a small, simple book of a few pages with lovely illustrations. Disney won the Oscar in 1938 for one of the best silly symphonies that's based on it. But like some of the other films from Blue Sky / 20th Century Fox, they're dealing with a story that is not a feature. It's a short, so it's enormously padded with side characters, most of whom we've seen before. There's a spunky girl who loves Ferdinand as a calf and in whose room he sleeps, which I can't begin to imagine. There are a couple of obnoxious hedgehogs who are basically the skater dude possums from the Ice Age films. It's a lot of padding, it's a lot of cliches, and it just confirms the feeling that the, again, Blue Sky Fox Studio has just felt adrift for a long time. Their films have done very well overseas for reasons I don't entirely understand.
What are some of their titles?
The Ice Age series.
Yeah.
You know, that's gotten done less and less well here. This is closer to the things they tried to do of the Dr. Seuss films, like Horton Hears a Who. There just isn't that much story there, and it feels padded and tired and like you've seen most of this before, and it has none of the charm of that Disney Silly Symphony.
I want to hear a mother's perspective,
Leo. You know what? Charles, I beg to differ. I look, perhaps...
Her lightsaber's turning white. She's whipping it out.
Perhaps as a piece of animation, it's nothing, you know, new or innovative. But as a piece of storytelling geared for children, I thought it was kind of remarkable in that it takes on a couple of really challenging topics, among which are animal cruelty and meat eating, carnivorism, and what happens to animals once they go to the butcher. I mean, it's not dealt with directly a lot, but it's there. And these are dark and heavy subjects that I thought the film touches on in a really interesting way. I thought, wow, this is kind of going deep. And my son really enjoyed it. So there. And so did Wade. I could hear him cackling the whole time.
Yeah. Yes. I brought
Would you take the opinion of someone who hated The Last Jedi?
Oh, good point.
You know, my daughter, who is four, not quite five, thoroughly enjoyed it. But I think she enjoyed me enjoying it more than she actually enjoyed the film. I laughed a lot. I will admit it. I think the... It again, Charles is right. It doesn't really. It's not as connected to the original Ferdinand as it perhaps should be. It's almost a completely independent thing, and the set pieces go on way too long. There are chase sequences that should be, you know, a tenth as long as they are. They really go overboard and they get very tired. The movie should be about 20 minutes shorter, but some of those peripheral characters are really fun. The hedgehogs, I thought, were hysterical.
And Kate McKinnon as the goat.
Kate McKinnon as a goat.
I mean, what can't she do?
She's trying to be Ellen.
And I did think about this.
She sounded a lot like
A little bit. There are three horses, three show horses that speak with these very aristocratic German accents, and they are absolutely hilarious.
But
so that
what
stuff
do they
is
have to do with the story?
You know, I don't care. They made me laugh.
They're just there for
they
comic,
made
relief.
Me laugh. It was comic relief.
It was endearing, and it had a message.
Stinky
you know?
Board. It made me laugh. And it did have a message. I mean, there are a lot of really wonderful moments here and some very good sight gags. One in particular that will just, it'll put you on the floor.
The force is not strong with this one.
Ferdinand, the animated comedy from director Carlos Saldana. It's rated PG in wide release. Wormwood, a six-part series directed by Errol Morris, co-written by Stephen Hathaway and Molly Rokas. Wade, get us started on this, and we'll come back to it after the break as well.
This is astonishing. This may be Errol Morris's masterpiece. It is very close to being my favorite film of the year. If it's not number one, it's somewhere there in the top five. And it starts on Netflix today. It's a six-part series on Netflix that is 4 hours and 18 minutes long. If you go to, I think it's a music hall where it's playing this week for a week, three shows a day. It is 4 hours, so it's 18 minutes shorter in its theatrical version, which is only 3 minutes longer than the Grateful Dead documentary, Long Strange Trip, which is also in my top 10. I have 2 4-hour-long documentaries. The story here, it is essentially the story of a government scientist who in 1953 committed suicide jumping out of a 13th-floor window in a New York hotel. The story that was told to the family was he'd been, you know, he was part of an LSD experiment and it's just things just went wrong. And, you know, he just, sorry, you know, too bad. And that's the story that was essentially bought by the family for 20 years until things started coming to light. And this is the story of the son as he tries to unravel the story of his father's death.
We'll come back to talk more about Wormwood from director Errol Morris, as Wade just said, at Lemley's Music Hall, Beverly Hills, and starting streaming today on Netflix. We have many more films to talk about. It's Film Week on KPCC.
Music.
It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us, and I hope you'll join me for our next Film Week screening series, Theater at Ace Hotel for the holidays. It's Die Hard Saturday night. So if you're listening to the Saturday broadcast, I mean tonight, Theater at Ace Hotel. If you're listening live on Friday, it's tomorrow night. Theater at Ace Hotel, 7 o'clock screening of Die Hard. And I'm going to be joined by two of our Film Week critics, Christy Lemire, Amy Nicholson, will be with me. Gradually, we're getting all our Film Week critics to join us for our screening series. Be a lot of fun. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. We continue with our critics, Leah Lowenstein, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon. We're talking about what's a little bit different than our typical movie to review. It's a six-part series from documentarian Errol Morris. It's streaming on Netflix, and it's at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. Multiple hours of the story. Wade, you want to just add a little bit more, and then we'll hear what Leah thought of
it. What's so astonishing about this is, I mean, it takes so many interesting twists and turns, and Morris is such an accomplished stylistic director, but what he's done here is something that's almost novel and unheard of, which is that in this 4 hours, he has shot an entire narrative feature film detailing the 10-day period during which all of these questionable events happened in 1953, with Peter Sarsgaard playing the part of the father, Molly Parker, the mother, Bob Balaban, Tim Blake Nelson, a lot of other great actors. Incredibly, maybe the best photographed feature film of the year. It is astonishing.
A docudrama. Who would guess?
It's astonishing. And he has taken this feature film, which has a lot of interesting questions of truth. There are some sort of alternate threads into certain events. And he's nested it in this fascinating series of interviews, most of which is with the son, some of which is with other figures, Seymour Hersh and some attorneys and others. And it just creates this unbelievable drama and mystery. And for 4 hours, you are just absolutely gripped by questions of truth and deception, and it takes on some incredible existential questions.
Leah, what do you think?
I completely concur. To me, this is just a perfect example of what Morris does at his best. He, from back in the days of the Thin Blue Line, when he kind of reinvented the documentary by adding elements of recreation and this sort of creepy Philip Glass score, and you know, made us rethink a murder and sort of question what we knew of truth. Morris has always been about sort of plumbing the depths of what is true and what isn't, and peeling back these layers of truth and proving that truth is really just one subjective layer after another, so that you, when you get to what you think is true in this story, you then realize, well, no, that's not really it either. So your footing is constantly shifting. It is fascinating what he's done with the drama within this film, because it, Morris sort of creates these new genres. This is not a documentary. This is not a drama. It's not a docudrama. It's many different things. It doesn't fit neatly into a box, but all of it is extraordinary. And from the technical innovations, where he invented this thing called the Interatron, which he doesn't use that
great
much.
Name.
Isn't that great?
Yes. Yeah. Even if it doesn't work, it's a great name.
It sounds like something in one of those, in a sci-fi movie.
It is. And in this case, he doesn't use it as much more. Morris is in the frame more often than not, unlike some of his other films. But he cuts up the image, and you'll see six images of this guy, Eric Olson. He splits the screen
split
and then
screens.
Splits it again. Or he'll use sound overdubbing and all of these different things, which really work beautifully and show us that, again, we don't really know what the truth is.
Wormwood is the documentary series, for lack of a better term, but it's screening in a continuous format, Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills, and over Netflix. It's unrated. Errol Morris, the director. And Morris was interviewed on The Frame this week. You can hear the full interview with Errol Morris by visiting kpcc.org/theframe. The Western, The Ballad of Lefty Brown, stars Bill Pullman, Peter Fonda, Kathy Baker, and Jim Caviezel. Jared Moshe is the writer-director. Wade, what'd you think?
I thought this was a perfectly competent, capable, serviceable Western with lots of familiar elements, but a wonderful performance by Bill Pullman, and Kathy Baker is very good. And I can't object to it. There's nothing here that I haven't seen in a thousand other Westerns. This, you know, 50 years, 60, 70 years ago, this might have been a Jimmy Stewart film. But I enjoyed Bill Pullman's performance, and even knowing every single twist and turn this film was going to take, I was there. I was along for the ride. So I didn't love it, but I didn't dislike it. I it was perfectly serviceable.
Lael?
I think this is all that what you said is all right. It is a very serviceable homage to the Western.
Yeah.
Pullman is really the right-hand man of the hero, played by Peter Fonda, who's dispatched it within just a few minutes in the beginning of the
Say
film.
It ain't so.
So he, yes, indeed. So he becomes the sort of unlikely hero, the anti-hero hero of this film. And it also touches on questions of, you know, much like Liberty Valance, for instance, what it is to be a legend or what it is to have a ballad about you. When there's a scene where this kid who becomes his sidekick, Pullman's sidekick, says, "Because you know, this is why no one's ever written about you, because you're sort of, you've never done anything heroic," basically. So he has to kind of come into his heroism. Yes, it brings up all the things you would expect from a Western, the shootout at the end, questions of honor, questions of, you know, land and so forth. But it's pretty good. Pretty good.
The Ballad of Lefty Brown is rated R. Jared Moshe, the writer-director. It's at Lemley's NoHo Theater, North Hollywood. A Quest is a documentary that looks at an American family in Philadelphia. Jonathan Olszewski is the director. Lael?
Oh, this was such a really wonderfully incisive and deeply troubling documentary. It's essentially like a verite piece of that tracks a family in North Philadelphia, an African American family, over maybe almost 8 years. And Quest is the nickname for the dad, whose name is Chris, I think. And there's a daughter, Chris, PJ, who's 13, and there's a mother, and they are living in the midst of horrible poverty. There's violence which affects their family, and it's what's extraordinary is the way they deal with these things and the way we, having very little to do with their lives, actually experience and are brought into it. It's kind of devastating and very moving.
Yeah, I agree that I wonder, I guess that they had spent so much time with the film crew there, they just sort of forgot about them because these moments are very clearly unrehearsed, very honest, that although they have very little, these are genuinely admirable people that you would be proud to know, dealing with very unfortunate circumstances, yet maintaining a dignity and an honor and an integrity that many others couldn't begin to aspire to.
Mm. Wade?
Yeah, the thing that always amazes me about these kinds of documentaries is the fly on the wall aspect, and Hoop Dreams had that as well. And I think we're so inundated with reality television where the presence of the camera in front of these people affects what they do. It's the Kardashianization of it, where everyone changes what they're doing and how they perform because the camera's there. And that's not the case here. These people are living their lives. They are true to the moment, and the camera is appears to be invisible to them. And there are some incredibly intimate, heartbreaking moments where it's extraordinary to me that they're able to capture that. And I don't know how they do it, but I give Olszewski all the credit in the world. It's a beautiful tapestry of one family's life over the course of a decade.
Jonathan Olszewski is the director of the documentary Quest. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, and it's unrated. The British animated film Ethel and Ernest features the voices of Jim Broadbent, Brenda Blethyn, and Luke Treadway. It's written and directed by Roger Mainwood. Charles?
Well, Raymond Briggs, whose graphic novel this is based on, is a very beloved figure in Britain. His work was the basis of The Very Charming Snowman back in 1982, and then the much less fun and much less charming The Wind Rises 4 years later. This tries to do in an hour and a half what Up did in less than 3 minutes, which is capture a marriage between two people who care about each other and go through various trials over the years. It's done in little tiny snippets. I doubt that any of the scenes last more than a minute. And it's like being handed a handful of tiles and told this is a mosaic. There's no reason to animate it. You could do this much more easily with Brenda Blethyn and Jim Broadbent, who are very good as voices, but who could just do more with this material. And it's the most boring animated film I've seen in years.
Lael?
This would be
Wade. Okay.
I'm a little more positive on it. I didn't dislike it. I think the animation it was different enough for me that I was able to sort of enjoy the recreation of this, you know, these decades of British history drawn in a very particular way. I just enjoy listening to Jim Broadbent and Broadbent and Brenda Blethyn. I just enjoy their conversations.
I understand that.
Yeah. I can have, you know, the two of them were just having tea for 2 hours. I'd love to sit at the table and just listen to the conversations. It's a wonderful, soothing camaraderie and chemistry that they have, even just if you're watching them as voice talent. Raymond Briggs obviously thinks that his parents' marriage and their experiences are a lot more interesting than they probably are to everyone else. But there is something about sort of experiencing this remarkable century through this marriage. And there are a lot of things in British history: the rise of labor, the moon landing, World War II, decriminalization of homosexuality, a lot of very relevant social moments that are part of their lives or that you experience through their marriage. And is it enough for a whole movie to hang on? Probably not, but there are enough bits and pieces to make it worthwhile.
Ethel and Ernest, the British animated film. It's unrated, written and directed by Roger Mainwood at the New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. The romantic drama The Leisure Seeker stars Helen Mirren and Donald Sutherland. Paolo Verzi is the director and co-screenwriter. Wade?
We have seen this movie many, many times. This is an older couple who are about to be sort of shoveled off to the home by their children, their son and daughter. And the father, Donald Sutherland, is coming down with dementia, and so they decide to go on one last fling and just go head out on a road trip in the camper, and drives the kids crazy. Where are you? And you know, then we sort of re-experience all of these late life turning points in the marriage. You know, recent years we've had L'Amour and we've had 45 Years, and you know, these kinds of movies are not new. There's nothing particularly revolutionary about this. Helen Mirren is wonderful, and Donald Sutherland is very, very good. I thought it was sort of treading water a little bit, but I did also watch it with my mother-in-law, who seemed to be very, very touched by it. So I will make an allowance and say that I think if you are of a certain age, that this will probably be more meaningful to you.
What do you think, Layla, the Leisure Seeker?
I thought it was a bit like an RV parked in a compact space.
I've never heard that analogy for a movie, but it's great.
It just didn't quite... fit, and it never really found its footing. I felt like it was neither serious enough nor comic enough. I couldn't tell what tone it was trying to go for, and I felt there were some things missing maybe from Sutherland's performance. I do love both of those actors, so I think
we tend to be a little forgiving when actors of that caliber do something that is maybe a step or two below.
Because you just like seeing them act.
Yeah. It was, to me, it just didn't quite get there.
But you got the quote of the day out of it later. I'm glad you just to hear that. The Leisure Seekers, rated R, Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles, and the reissue of the 1966 drama Shakespeare, Walla, from Merchant Ivory. Wade, quick thought on it?
Yeah, this is a wonderful movie. This was the number two, this was the second film that the Merchant Ivory team made, written by Ruth Powerjabvala, original script, about a Shakespearean... roaming itinerant Shakespearean troupe in India who's sort of trying to maintain the interest of the small audiences that they go to. There's some commentary on the rise of Bollywood at that time as well. It's a really, really lovely film. Great performances, especially by Madhur Jaffray, who's just tremendous, and the Kendall family, on whose experiences this is based. They also appear in it.
Shakespeare, Walla, from 1966, re-released on the big screen of Lemley's Fine Arts Theater in Beverly Hills. It's unrated. Coming up on Film Week, our critics and a special guest joins us to talk about 20th Century Fox Film Studios and what's changing with the acquisition by Disney. That to come right after this update. The famous fanfare of 20th Century Fox. Good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Now the question is, will you ever hear that or a variation of that fanfare going forward? This because of Disney's pending $52 billion plus acquisition of most of 21st Century Fox, which includes the Fox studio feature and television production units. We're going to talk about the history of Fox as well well as what this means at this juncture in the major studios here in Southern California. And we're very pleased to have with us from UCLA School of Theater, Film and Television, film historian and lecturer, and a man very well known to two of our critics here, Lael and Wade, Jonathan Koontz. Professor, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I understand Lael was your TA.
That's right.
While a student at UCLA, and
yes.
Wade was a student. Of
I was. I got an A. Thank
you. So great to have you with us. So, Professor, what has Fox Studios been known for? What's its calling card?
Well, Fox, you know, in some ways is Hollywood. It was there at the very beginning. William Fox, who created the Fox Studios, was really the leader in the movement to resist the Edison Patents Trust. And with the resulting defeat of the Edison Patents Trust, Hollywood could grow. And Fox was one of the very first companies there. In addition, William Fox in the teens and 20s, in the early days of Hollywood, was one of the leaders to expand Hollywood, to move towards vertical integration, where a Hollywood studio would control production, distribution, and exhibition.
There's a building down on Broadway in downtown L.A., I think, that Fox actually had when he first came to Los Angeles.
Since he was here more than 100 years ago, downtown L.A. was the center of L.A., briefly, at least in that period of the 19-teens.
Yeah, and the Fox Bruin in Westwood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the Fox Theater chain, of course, as well as the Bruin, was huge.
The Fox Theater chain that's built up in the 1920s, it ends up being more than 500 movie houses, mostly in the western United States. They were a dominant force right here in California.
And what are the types of films that became, you know, during, I guess you'd say, the glory days of the studio system, was Fox known for?
Well, Fox put out, at least they tried to put out, 50 feature films a year, so they put out all kinds of stuff. They wanted to cover the whole market. In the days of William Fox, in the silent era, they were famous for their quality pictures, and they had a whole pile of great filmmakers working at Fox in the late 1920s, led by F.W. Murnau and John Ford and Raoul Walsh and Frank Borzage. Then in the 20th century Fox days, when Daryl F. Zanuck and Joseph Skenk take over in 1935, Fox did all kinds of things. Some people used to make fun of them a little, calling them 19th century Fox because they specialized in nostalgic portraits of the late 19th century. But they did everything from Betty Grable musicals to film noir like Laura by Otto Preminger.
All right. We're talking about the history of Fox Studios, but also about its future. Wade, you have some very strong feelings about the fact that Disney is making this move. How do you think it's going to affect the creative community?
I think it's going to be bad. I don't see an upside to it. It behooves the creative community to have a lot of different entities, a lot of different buyers, a lot of different places to go, because then everyone is afraid. Hollywood is driven by fear of missing out. No one really sort of aspires to do the next big thing. They're afraid that someone else will get the next big thing. So that's what sort of drives it. And if you have this kind of consolidation, it removes one of the major players. Losing a major studio is not a good thing. And the problem for me here, primarily from an economic standpoint, is Fox is not insolvent. Fox is not crumbling. Fox is a profitable studio. It's been a very profitable studio, but it's not making the grade as a publicly owned company for the Murdochs. And this is the problem with publicly owned studios, which is if you're serving the public, that's great. You just need to be profitable. You need to cover your overhead and deliver great movies. But if you're publicly owned, you're not serving the public, you're serving shareholders. And shareholder value, if you're an innovative company like a tech company, you can do Microsoft Word 2.0 and 3.0 and build
on
that.
It still won't work.
But at least you're adding on to things in a way that increases shareholder value. You can't do that with a creative business. You restart every single time, and Steven Spielberg's next movie may not be better than his last movie.
But these being owned by publicly held companies, I mean, that ship sailed a long time ago, Wade.
It did, and the problem now is that we've entered an era where everyone expects that your quarterly earnings need to be exponentially more than your previous quarterly earnings. And if they can't squeeze that out of a creative business, then they need to find other ways of increasing shareholder value. And mergers seem to be it's the last resort. It's the only thing they have. And if we see more of these, we're going to be in trouble.
But so Disney hasn't been, I'm sorry, I just wanted to jump in, but Disney has been, you know, printing money.
I know. But, and they're the
but
only
this
ones.
Is a future play yeah. for them. This is about the streaming service, of course, and, yeah. and rights to content. I want to go back, though, to Professor Kuntz. Where do you put this in the evolution of the business side of Hollywood?
It's pretty huge. I mean, in some ways, maybe this is marking the end of an era. We had the original studio era with the big five and little three studios that dominated when movies were the dominant form of mass entertainment in the United States and Hollywood controlled production, distribution, and exhibition. Then we had the second half of the 20th century, you might say, and the early 21st century, which ended up giving us these six global entertainment conglomerates that have pretty much dominated the last 30 or 40 years. But now, in the second decade of the 21st century here, the big names that you hear as often in Hollywood are, you know, Netflix and Amazon. You're less likely to hear about them as you are about Paramount and Columbia. And so I think maybe we have reached a turning point here in Hollywood or a new era.
It seems that this is driven really by new distribution models and maybe the movie theater not being as big a play going forward. I mean, this is kind of a vote against the future of the theatrical experience in some ways, isn't it?
Certainly, but maybe this is just recognizing something that's been going on since the 1950s, maybe, is the fact that the theatrical tradition, which many of us love, seeing movies in a community there on the big screen, maybe that's not so important in the 21st century.
That's certainly the case with a lot of younger audiences. I mean, they love anime, but that is not something you go and see in the theater. You watch it on your phone, you watch it on your computer, you watch it at home with your friends. It's not a theatrical experience at all.
Yeah, many young people actually don't care on in which format they see things. It's just as easy. If it's easier for them to see it on their phone, they're happy to do it. That's why they've lost sort of the joy and the movie-going experience, I think, in the way that we used to know it.
Well, maybe they have that joy, but it's only once or twice a year when Star Wars comes out.
Right, yeah. Right.
So it's got to be a particular type of film. And, in fact, Disney has invested a lot in that product with Marvel, and Pixar movies are in that category.
Lucasfilm.
Yeah, so they've clearly gone in that direction. You're listening to Film Week on KPCC. Larry Mantle with film historian and lecturer from UCLA's School of Theater, Film, and TV. Jonathan Kuntz also with us. Our film critics, Leo Lowenstein, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon. We're talking about what changes this brings to Hollywood in the wake of Disney's pending acquisition of the studio assets of 21st Century Fox, the feature film and the television production. Charles, what are your thoughts about what this means for animation on the Fox lot?
Good question, because Disney already has their own studio and Pixar. Well, if you've got Tiffany and Cartier, why do you need, you know, the equivalent of the jewelry department at Macy's? Blue Sky / Fox has not been that innovative a force for a long time. I don't think Disney needs a third animation studio doing theatrical releases. They may switch them to doing things for, you know, for video, for streaming, for TV. I don't know, but it's also kind of hard to imagine Homer and Marge walking around Disneyland as part of the attractions. In fact, as I mentioned before, Matt Groening did a very funny cartoon that's on the web now of Homer throttling Mickey Mouse and Bart saying, "Welcome to the family, man."
Yeah, I wonder. And the tone of the companies being different also is an issue. Lael, quick thought on that. You know, Disney had, what was it, Touchstone Films for a while that was more adult-oriented.
And Buena Vista.
And Buena Vista distributing. Yeah, so it's not all family content Disney's
right.
done. Right.
We've seen sort of different strata of filmmaking within these different companies and these conglomerates. So this isn't new. And, of course, Star Wars was a Fox property until it became a Disney property. So that's not the first time. But it's kind of ominous to think about where it's going to go.
And we'll pick up on that thought. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, live every Friday at 11. Every Saturday we come your way at noon. We'll be back in 1 minute. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by our critics Charles Solomon, Leo Lowenstein, and Wade Major, and UCLA film historian and lecturer Jonathan Kuntz with us from UCLA School of Theater, Film, and Television. I remind you that our next Film Week screening series is Die Hard, and I hope you'll join us Theater at Ace Hotel. It's Saturday night, so if you're listening live Friday, we mean tomorrow night. If you're listening to Saturday noon's broadcast, I mean tonight, you can get your tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. Our screening of Die Hard starts at 7 o'clock tonight, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown L.A., and I hope to see you there. We're talking about the pending acquisition of most of the assets of 21st Century Fox by the Walt Disney Company. And the assets of great importance here, the feature film, television production division, the Fox lot, which has very historic stages and properties and tremendous amount of Hollywood history, is being retained by Fox. That doesn't go to Disney. Professor Kuntz, can you talk about the historic nature of the lot itself?
Well, when Fox first came to Los Angeles, the first lot they built was on Western Avenue, kind of in East Hollywood. But in 1928, in the boom of the Roaring Twenties and with the success of Fox Movietone, their sound system, William Fox builds Movietone City in Western Los Angeles, which is now Century City. And that lot's been there now, I guess, almost 90 years. Although it should be noted that the original 20th Century Fox lot in West L.A. was almost four times bigger than the current one. The current one was a downsized version from the sell-offs in the 50s and 60s and 70s that created Century City and the malls and the theaters and the condos there.
I didn't realize, so it was about three-quarters of the original Fox lot was sold off to create Century City.
Yes.
I was going to say that was after Cleopatra lost so
the
much
disaster
money, wasn't
of
it?
The losses of Cleopatra and Something's Got to Give and other mismanaged films of the early 60s at Fox.
Something we saw similarly with MGM, where they sold off all the acreage of their back lot and apartment buildings in Culver City, all built adjacent to what was then MGM Studios.
Is MGM an example of an original classic Big Five Hollywood company that really is but a shadow of its former self? And maybe, unfortunately, that might be the future of Fox.
Yeah, I was just gonna ask you. You think that is the closest comparable to what we have now with Fox?
It might be. I mean, RKO, MGM, UA, classic Hollywood companies that really don't function anymore. Fox may have to join them. We were just talking about Fox Searchlight under Disney. We know what happened to Miramax under Disney. Mm. We're all hoping that we won't see a similar fate for Fox
Searchlight.
Yeah,
wait. What do you think is the likely future of the specialty film division's Fox Searchlight?
Disney as a company has shown no interest, at least in the Iger era, of having anything that is not quantifiable and predictable and easily marketable. Everything has to sort of have all kinds of ancillary options. And I think unless they see value in Fox Searchlight as something that can fuel their streaming division and that can give them Netflix-type movies and Amazon-type movies, I think it may very well be discontinued. I think Disney likes predictability and independent films, foreign films, the kinds of movies that we love, they're not predictable.
So it's similar to your concern, Charles, about, you know, what does this mean for feature animation?
Well, and even for television animation. You know, the Fox network was largely created by The Simpsons. Mm. Which is so different in tone, and the other shows that have joined the Fox lineup, I assume that because they're so valuable selling overseas as they do, that those will continue, probably with minimal interference, because they're enormously popular worldwide. I think The Simpsons is how would you get away from them in the world? They're everywhere.
Yeah, longest-running series and all. Professor Kuntz, what about possible antitrust issues here? Is that a potential snag?
That can definitely be a problem with the Department of Justice because we are seeing a huge consolidation of ownership going on here. There also may be FCC hurdles, although it appears that most of the broadcasting properties are not changing hands here. But there will definitely be, just as there was with the Comcast Universal NBC deal, there's obviously going to be regulatory hurdles, and it's going to be a year or two before we find out what's really going to happen. And we're already seeing that, of course, with the AT&T Time Warner.
Are there particular genres of films, I mean, aside from the art house division, Fox Searchlight, that you think might end up being in shorter supply with Disney taking over Fox's production? Any of you have a thought on that?
You just talked about Die Hard. I mean, Die Hard is a Fox property, and Die Hard most significantly was, you know, Die Hard is one of those films in the Alien series as well, when it went to Alien versus Predator. Those two did something that we had not seen before, which is those were franchises that started as R-rated movies and eventually became PG-13 rated movies so as to broaden their base. And there was a question about Deadpool, you know, now that because there are all these Marvel properties that are part of Fox's license that will now revert back to Disney, including X-Men and, of course, Deadpool. And Deadpool is, most famously, is R-rated. And that's what made it popular. And there was a you know, Robert Iger was very upfront saying Deadpool can continue to be R-rated under Disney, which is a wonderful thing. But the fact that he even had to say that makes people raise an eyebrow and say, well, okay, so if R-rated is the exception now, if you need a special dispensation from leadership to be R-rated, what's going to happen to all of those other R-rated adult-themed franchises that Fox has, namely Alien, Die Hard, etc.?
Well, when was it that Warner Brothers bought the MGM archive?
When Ted Turner severed MGM from its libraries.
And so that's a precedent for this as well, because I think that was sort of the beginning of MGM's kind of losing its brand recognition and sort of dissipating, you know, from what we all remembered it as. And I feel like that's probably what's going to happen here, that Fox, as the sort of iconic emblem of its own pictures, is going to be going away.
And I'm glad you raised that, Leo, because that was a content-driven thing.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers really was, you know, looking for that MGM library to service cable channels, which were new, and they needed content for that. And now it's streaming services and that the beast that needs to be fed.
That begat some controversies in terms of colorization and other such things.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were unhappy with what was being done to the archive.
That also happened when a European conglomerate bought the Filmation studio that had turned out so much Saturday morning stuff, they just closed it because they wanted the library.
Who was the guy, Lou? What was his name?
Lou.
Who was behind him? I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I didn't mean to stump you. Anyway.
Not Saperstein. Lou Scheimer.
Scheimer. Thank you very much.
20th Century Fox's greatest stars were Shirley Temple and Marilyn Monroe. Shirley Temple would have fit in real good at Disney. Marilyn Monroe, I don't know.
Man, very different image. That would have been for certain. In closing, Professor Kuntz, want to give you a chance to, you know, sort of share your thoughts. I mean, you're a historian. Your love of history is what's led you down this professional path. What are your emotions about this?
Well, looking backward, of course, it's kind of sad to see one of the classic Hollywood companies, a company that's been around for more than 100 years and whose name is 20th Century Fox, is synonymous with Hollywood, kind of being passed by in the 21st century. And I think, you know, the founders and the people that built up the company, which is William Fox and Daryl F. Zanuck and Joseph Schenck in the classic era, they were guys who were dedicated to motion pictures. They spent their whole life in the movie business. If they were working a deal at this moment, it would be to expand their influence in the film business. It's kind of sad that, you know, with Rupert Murdoch, obviously a person who's not exactly dedicated to the film business or the theatrical film, it's maybe more of a money deal.
Professor, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it. Jonathan Kuntz, UCLA School of Theater, Film and TV, film historian and lecturer. And thanks to our critics this week, Leo Lowenstein, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon. Hope you're having a wonderful start to your weekend. And we remind you, Film Week screening series, Theater at Ace Hotel, Saturday night at 7. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person.